Another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't dictate it. It's almost always the case during my 50-mile commute between Arlington in Frisco, Texas. Today's show is going to be interesting. I'm going to talk about a few things that have been going on out there as part, I guess you'd say, a midway point between the house cleaning and the main topic of today's show, including some stuff that Jim Rogers has been saying about investing, and that might have a real lot to do with what we're going to talk about today, because what we're going to talk about is going from home to homestead, a subject that I talked about a very long time ago, back in the days of crappy audio. The next thing we're going to talk about today a little bit is just somebody sent me a story this morning about Hummer, the sale of Hummer to a Chinese company being blocked, and what my thoughts are on that. And we'll do our normal house cleaning. And then we're going to get into what's the difference between a home and a homestead, and how can you start to transform your house from a home as a consumer to a homestead as a producer, no matter where you live, whether it's in the city or in the country. And I have some other things that have been going on in comments and emails in the forum and the blog that I'm going to talk about intermittent between this. So I'm going to try to keep this one changed up. Don't have much of an outline today. I basically just read you my outline, okay? But let's start out with the house cleaning. First of all, make sure you're supporting our advertisers, okay? Our advertiser of the day is SOE Tactical Gear, John Willis's organization, and those guys are great. And I told him he was up in queue and said, is there anything you want to tell people, any specials or anything like that? One, he wanted you to know he's taking orders direct. If you want to go to a site, just order directly. You don't have to buy through a reseller. But the big thing, like most good leaders, he wanted to pass on the opportunity to someone else. And what he really wanted to do was have me say a shout-out to his crew of Amanda, Melinda, Ronzo, and Linda. Amanda, Melinda, Ronzo, and Linda. Let me say something to you guys directly. You guys kick ass. You rock. Thank you for demonstrating what the American worker is capable of. Folks, if you've never put your hands on a piece of SOE's gear, you need to do it. You need to understand something. If you want to buy something that you're going to replace at some point in your life, go buy some, you know, imported knockoff gear. If you want to buy something and have it for the rest of your life, no matter how hard you push it, how hard you work it, and you want a piece of gear that can be handed down to your kids and after you're dead can still be used, buy something that these four individuals make. You'll never replace it at any point in your life. It is the best stuff I've ever seen like it. I won't make any apologies for saying that to anybody else who might build similar gear who it might offend. You'll have to show me before I'll say there's anything on par with it. Next thing, I've been saying this all week. It's going to be the last time I mention it. I really want to get on the Judge's show, Freedom Watch. We have 2,210 votes. The poker people who are number one have 2,234 votes. I need 24 votes out of you guys. It's not much. You can give me three if you haven't done it yet. I'll put a link in today's show notes. Go by, give me a vote. See if you can think about registering and posting a comment if you have time today. The more comments we have, the better we'll do than just raw votes, and we'll see if we can get on there. Next, Shannon Appleby is putting together a Region 6 get-together up near Iowa. Go by the Region 6 board. Check out what he's doing. He's got some really good people set up to come out and talk and give workshops and things like that. What he needs is more attendance from TSP listeners. So get in touch with Shannon. And then the last thing is, if you think you get more than a quarter an episode of value out of the Survival Podcast, if you spend 30 to 50 minutes a day with me and you think it's worth dropping a quarter in a slot, consider joining the Members Support Brigade. You'll get some exclusive content only available to members, but more importantly, you'll help support the show. And you're leading me, folks, to a point where I'm going to be able to do this full-time and not from a car, and bring in great guests and have people call in. And I've even figured out a way to do my broadcast with live streaming video when I get to the point where I'm able to do that. So you'll be able to download the podcast just like you've always done, or you'll be able to tune in live and watch the show get done. That's where we're headed with this thing, and it's people supporting the show that are making that type of thing possible. Let's take like a little sideline fun question here before I talk about these little two news stories and then get into the meat of the topic. A person that lives in DFW, and I won't say her name. She gives me really great questions, but I don't know that, you know, they want to be revealed. A lot of people want some want to be anonymous, okay, with who they are. But she lives in the local DFW area, and she just said, just a fun question, are the American Idol tryouts that are going on in Arlington today going to slow down your commute from Arlington since they're going to be in Arlington? Actually, no. And I'm kind of bummed. I really am, because I had to deal with this every year until they built a new stadium over in Arlington. They used to do this at, you know, the Cowboys Stadium in Irving, right on Loop 12, which I drive past every day. In fact, I spent so much time stuck in traffic at the Cowboys Stadium on, you know, right there on Loop 12, right where it merges with 35. It's become known as my spot. My wife will call me and go, "Where are you at, honey? Are you on your way home or on your way to work?" And I'm like, "I'm in my spot." And she knows exactly what I mean. Well, I used to watch all these freaks that were dressed up in all these weird clothes walking to Texas Stadium from these kind of weird parts of Irving. And I didn't mind being stuck in traffic watching that, so no, it won't interfere today. But I'm kind of, you know, bummed about it. I actually enjoyed driving past that scene for several years. It was kind of cool. Now, let's talk about this thing, this Chinese blocking the sale of Hummers. I thought the Chinese were buying Hummer. Well, it's a company in China. I can't pronounce the name of it, and I didn't write it down, so I don't know, but they're pretty much a heavy equipment manufacturing company. They make, you know, these big construction trucks and stuff like that. They don't have a lot of experience with retail vehicles to the public. But they got the cash, and they got Hummer on a song if the deal goes through. The Chinese government is concerned that there's not going to be enough demand for Hummers, and that this might be a bad move for this company to make, because China is still a communist country, folks. The government can step in and say, "We're not going to let you do that because we don't think it's in your best interest." I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. I don't know what's going on there. Take a look. I'll put a link to the story today. It's very brief. It's pretty much says what I just said. But it does kind of throw a hole in some of my conspiracy theories, I guess, if you want to call them that, about the grand plan for China to enter the premium auto industry in 2010, which I think they still plan on doing. I thought that maybe if they bought Hummer and they had all those nice Hummer dealerships and all those, you know, well-to-do neighborhoods, even with all the financial problems, that when they put the new car by Brilliance on the lot next to it, that it would be a perfect symbiotic relationship. But I guess there's plenty of vacant lots that used to be GM and Chrysler lots for them to pick up at next to nothing. So I don't know what to think about this one yet. And I'm not going to make something up just to try to prove that I'm smart, folks. Sometimes I don't know, and this is one of them. So this is an interesting one to keep an eye on. Now, the next one that I think is going to be very applicable to what we're going to talk about today is what famed investor Jim Rogers has to say about what he's doing with his money right now. This guy's worth billions of dollars. Okay, this guy's filthy rich. And, you know, he got that way founding a fund back in, I think, 1970 in cooperation with George Soros. So a lot of people don't have a positive view of Jim Rogers because of his association with George Soros. Soros is a socialist statist. Let me tell you, folks, Jim Rogers is a libertarian. So Jim Rogers, as far as I'm concerned, is a good guy. He just made an awful lot of money. And you can debate the ethics of making the money, but somebody was going to make the money, and he did it. And I do believe that he knows what he's doing with money. In fact, I don't like George Soros at all, but I also believe that he knows what he's doing with money, too. So I pay attention to both of these guys because they're good indicators of what's going to happen next. Well, what Jim Rogers has said right now is he no longer is holding a single, not holding, he didn't say he wasn't holding any stock. I don't know if he's holding stocks or not. But he has nothing to recommend that you buy right now in the stock market. He's not buying any stocks, he's not buying any funds, and he has nothing that he says you should buy. You'd think, okay, well, that must mean that he's shorting, right? So for the first time in his life, he's not holding any shorts in the American stock market. He's not shorting any stocks, which means he would make money if they went down. He's not buying any stocks, which would mean he would make money if they went up. What does that tell you? I think Mr. Rogers, not the one we all grew up with as a kid, I think Mr. Rogers is saying, welcome to Japan, 1990. Where the market went sideways. It didn't go up or down, really, for 10 years. That's how I read the position. It could be he just isn't sure enough to go either way. But when you see somebody step out of a market who's very astute at playing it on the up and the down and they want out, period, that tells you that maybe what they see is sideways. It also tells you maybe he doesn't have trust in the currency system anymore either. He said he no longer has a single British pound in his portfolio. He's gotten out of all his British money, and that soon, whatever soon means, he won't be holding any American dollars. Now, you might want to wonder where to put your money. Somebody recently, with all my talk about the BRIC Alliance, said maybe we should put some money into ruples. I don't advise you where to invest your money. Buying some ruples might not be a bad idea just for the novelty. And I don't know, you know, a few hundred dollars worth or something. I can't advise you to invest heavily in the ruble. Not because I don't think that Russia was going to become a major player in the new world currency, because I don't know when. And I don't know how much volatility there could be in the meantime. And I don't know that you might need your money, and it might be really hard to get out if the ruble gets very weak against the dollar during some kind of shenanigans. So it's a gamble I'm not willing to play. And apparently Jim Rogers isn't putting his money in ruples either. One of the best currencies, he says, that you could put your money into right now is the Canadian dollar. He thinks it's one of the strongest currencies in the world. And it's something I'm going to consider. I'm not going to tell you to do it. You got to do what you want with this information. You got to do more research on your own. But I'm really thinking about buying a significant amount of Canadian dollars, basically in the form of, if I can figure out exactly how I want to do it, opening up a bank account that holds Canadian dollars. All right? And I don't mean my life savings, but some chunk, because I think there's a lot of value there. And hold on, folks. I'm slowing down here. I got a cop. What's he up to? He's bothering a working man on his way to work, pulled over in a Mustang. Oh, great. Anyway, so that's where Jim Rogers is at. But here's the two things that he said that I think should have the biggest impact on us in the way we view things going forward, not so much how we invest our money. Number one, best place for your money, he said right now, isn't even metals. Soft commodities, which means food, okay, and farmland. And I talked about this a few episodes ago. He's buying big farms, buying the whole damn thing, lock, stock, and barrel. Well, he's also saying investing in food commodities is a good play as well. This was the one that bugged me the most, because it's starting to prove that this guy agrees with me on the way the world is turning. And the new world alliance of the BRIC nations is going to really do for us, or do to us. He basically said, I don't remember the exact words, but if you are living in London, you're screwed. You better move east. I don't know, guys. You know, this guy's pretty astute. He starts telling you to move east from London. There's only one place that's going to take you. Russia in the Far East. And I'm India. So, I mean, I'm just telling you that all this stuff that some of you guys seem to think I'm totally nut job about, and I'm crazy, and this whole BRIC thing isn't really worth worrying about, and the Brazilians and the Indians are really our friends. And I think they are. They're our friends, but when your friend is doing something self-destructive, you don't go down the rat hole with them. You'll try to pull them out, but if they don't come along, okay, think about it like this. We're like a drug addict in this country with money and paper currency and fake money and consumption, consumption, consumption. All we do is consume, and when we run out of money, we bail everybody out and we print more. So we're a crack addict, all right? Now, you have a friend that's a crack addict, all right? And you have some other friends that are not crack addicts. Now, when it comes to investing in your future, who are you going to side with, the crack addict or the non-crack addict? You know, I got to tell you, even if I think that the guy that's a crack addict in his heart and soul is a better man, I can't trust his judgment because he's too busy being hooked on crack. And that's what I think India and Brazil is looking to when they look to Russia and China as allies financially. Okay. These guys aren't the greatest guys in the world, but they really don't mean us any harm, and they're not crack addicts, right? And they're dealing with the same crack addict we are, and the crack addict is unresponsive and wants to continue to smoke crack. So That's why I see all this stuff coming to a head eventually. I'm just not one of these idiots that comes out and goes, it will be in 5 years. It will be in 8 years. It'll be in 2 years. Because you don't freaking know. You can read the writing on the wall in these things. You can see the direction that they're heading. That's not a difficult thing to ferret out. It really isn't. But you don't know when it's going to happen. And the people that say they do are generally wrong. What they do is they put a number on it like 5 years. Well, 5 years is so long that people forget that they said it if it doesn't happen. And they just keep saying within 5 years. And like they do that for 3 years. And now 5 years is really 8 years, okay? And they just wait because they know sooner or later it'll happen, and they'll say, see, I predicted this. And they'll put a tape or a video on of them, you know, in 2005, and something happens in 2009, saying within 5 years. And, they ignore the fact that they said it in 1999, too, that it would be within 5 years. So I don't put numbers on that, and that's why I can't say, do 100% of this with your money. If any of us could do that, we'd all be rich, right? So how does this all pertain to today's subject of home to homestead? Well, if you see Jim Rogers put his money into food, it tells you there's going to be food shortages. If you see him saying move to the east because the wealth is going to leave the west, that means that we're going to have turmoil in our own nation. And that to create stability, we need more people that are able to be at least somewhat self-sufficient. And the more people that are somewhat self-sufficient, the less pressure will be created by those who are not. And if we don't have, you know, the end of days, you know, apocalypse scenarios where everything's gone and the land is raped, but what we have are very, very tough times, that stabilizing force of a few million people comes into play and helps the whole thing from going to that apocalypse. All right? What I do here is more about preemption than dealing with an inevitable complete decline to zero. See, I don't think the decline to zero is necessary. I do think we're going to have some real problems. And I've had a couple people point out to me that maybe I don't talk enough about the government being part of the problem. In the breakdown, riots, government goon squads, that type of thing. I'm going to do that next week. Because you guys are right. That stuff is a real threat too. But you need to focus on yourself, and that's why I want to talk about this today. So what I'm saying is most people live in homes of some sort, condo, apartment, house, doesn't matter what it is. But they're homes, they're houses. They're not homesteads. And there's a simple defining difference between the two. If you live in a homestead, it is a provider more than it is a consumer. Any home you have will consume something. Energy, time, money, resources, okay? But my question to you then would be, well, what do you get back out of it? Not what is its resale value, because that's irrelevant, because as we've all just learned, that supposed resale value could be cut in half or worse overnight. It's no guarantee. But production from the home back to the user is a constant. It's always there. Just because something's more expensive or less expensive doesn't change the return. All right? So you have to judge, how much food does my house and its surrounding property produce for me? How much value is there in having the roof over my head and the four walls around us? The heat and the cool. But on the same side, okay, it's 110 degrees today or something like that it's going to be. 103, actually, exaggerated there, but 103 degrees is a high projected today. So when I go home today, and it's 101, 102 at 5:30 at night, and I go in my house and I kick the AC down to 72 degrees, and I'll do that, and Barack Obama can kiss my ass if he doesn't like the carbon my AC unit produces. And I sit down in front of my TV and watch a little bit of TV before we go out and have a couple margaritas tonight, where I'll burn some more carbon in my big old truck, because I'm only going a few miles, so I'll drive the truck instead of the Jetta. It's going to cost me money. It's going to cost me money to run that air conditioner. And all I'm saying is start to look at, well, how much time and effort does it cost you to run that AC for a month? If your electric bill is $300, how much of it's your air conditioner? Is it $100.50? Or your heat? Is it $100.50 for your heat? What is it? What's the cost? How many hours do you work? How much consumption is there by your home to provide that back to you? And that's when you start really looking at the value of alternative energy sources like personal solar, personal wind. and at least taking some of that production capacity back and giving it to your home. See, you got to think about the way that the whole original concept of a homestead started when people first came to America. They saved up a little bit of money and they went out and either claimed or bought a 40-acre piece of land somewhere in the middle of the woods. You know, you didn't go out and buy a house the way that you do today. Or was it a bulldozer to clear it off and take 40 acres and build, oh, I don't know, 300 homes on 40 acres? Put little fences in and create little suburban streets with electrical lines and gas lines and phone lines and everything we take for granted today. No, you got to the land and it was harsh, brutal reality. Overgrown, thick, you know, swamp or woods or forest. And you didn't have a chainsaw. You had an axe. And a crosscut saw, a two-man saw. And you didn't have a bulldozer, you had a plow. A horse, a mule, donkey, chickens, rabbits. You get the picture. It was hard. It was tough. And that's why people generally didn't settle in mountainous regions. They looked for flat land, because at least it made a little bit of what you were doing a bit easier to get done. And they would go in and there would hack out an existence on this land, and they would basically put together a shack. That would be their first step in transforming a piece of raw land into a homestead. No heat, no electricity, nothing. Just a shack. And from that shack, they would begin to harvest the trees right off the land and build the foundation that would become a cabin. And eventually, maybe people would move into the area and there'd be a sawmill available. You'd take your wood down to the mill and have it cut, and you could build something that looked more like a proper house. Along the way, they would start, you know, after they built like a basic dirt floor shack with a fireplace, they'd start digging a hole. That hole would become the foundation of a root cellar. And when they got that root cellar completed, they would extend the house, the shack, over top of it, and begin to build and add on to the home. And they would create a home out of the materials from the land. At the same time, they would be clearing pieces of the land and beginning to plant their crops and food. And in the end, 2 to 3 years of hard work, and hopefully nobody died from disease, illness, sickness, hardship, or starvation, they would have their homestead. And that homestead would then provide for them for many, many years. Many times handed down 2 or 3 generations, continuously improved and built up, but always seen as something that produced. Notice what I didn't say. They didn't take their covered wagon and swing by Wells Fargo, even though they use a covered wagon for their little, you know, graphics in their advertising. They didn't go to Wells Fargo, get a mortgage. It wasn't part of the process. They didn't phone up a builder and say, hey, Tom, you guys build custom homes. Can you come down and build me a custom home? I want to pick out my carpet. They didn't, you know, they just went out and did it. And because of that, they valued what they had so much more than I think we do today. They never turned to somebody else and said, hey, Tom, you sold me on this land being worth something, and it's worthless. It's your fault that I'm stuck with this house. I just didn't do things that way. And I know we can't go back to those days, and in some ways, we don't want to. That was a harsh... Can you imagine clearing 2 or 3 acres of land with nothing but an axe and a saw? Have you ever cleared an acre of land with a chainsaw? You know, chainsaw and manual labor, clearing an acre. It's a lot of work, folks. Especially if you do it by yourself. And a lot of times these homesteaders were like a man and a woman. And the woman wouldn't be part of clearing the land. A guy would go out and clear an acre of land with an axe, alone. Or maybe with the help of a couple sons. And when they had to move a big log, they would have to get a mule or a donkey or a horse and pull it with that. This is the way these things used to happen. So there are some reasons, you know, typhoid, cholera, all these different diseases that people are treated for today pretty easily. We don't even have them spreading much because of sanitation. These were all concerns back then. So there's some of these things we don't want to go back to, but some of the wisdom that they had to deal with all that shit, and they did a good job of dealing with it. We can learn from that. So you should start looking at your land. I don't care if it's a postage stamp lot in the suburbs. If it's a rooftop that you can turn into a garden in the city, or it's a tenth of an acre, or half an acre, a third of an acre, or 5 acres, start asking yourself a question. what here produces and what here consumes. Be very, very tough in your judgment. One of the most perfect examples I can give you of something that produces almost nothing and consumes a lot is the average American lawn. Now, there's a place for a lawn. It's nice for kids to run and play in. It's good for dogs to run around in. It's pretty. It gives you some joy. So it does produce some things. Let's not be too hard on a blade of grass. The grass is useful. Now, if you want to make it really useful, plant some freaking clover with your grass so it'll nitrify itself. You won't have to put fertilizers and chemicals on it. And it'll provide food for a lot of animals like rabbits. Love to eat clover. When I lived in Pennsylvania, we had about an acre. It was a huge field full of clover and grass. And there were rabbits in that field all the time. It was really cool. If you wanted to eat a rabbit, you could pretty much just go out and shoot one in the head with a pellet gun. Yep. That harsh, that mean, that real. But you know what? Rabbit tastes good. And they were there simply because there was clover in this grass instead of just grass. And the guy, and I had a guy, because I traveled back then, I had a guy that cut my grass for me. Because he had a landscape business, but he lived across the street from me. So he cut it for, like, dirt cheap. Like, I figured out, it was way too big of a place to cut with a push mower. And I figured out that if I went out and bought a tractor and did it myself, including gas, it would take me, like, 8 years to break even on paying this guy what I used to pay him every 2 weeks to come over with his two tractors and cut everything for me. And but that's why they were there. And he wanted to get rid of the clover for me. He said, "Why don't you let me treat this stuff? I'll get rid of that clover." I said, "Don't you touch that clover, Joe. Don't you see? Look how beautiful that is." And he, since he was a landscaper, all he could see was it was ruining the pretty little uniformity of the great blades of grass. And all I could see was, "I don't let you cut it every week. I let you cut it every other week." And by the time you cut it, there's those beautiful white flowers everywhere, and there's bumblebees out there, and they're pollinating my garden. And you don't understand that, and I understand why. But you know what? Don't you dare put a chemical on my lawn. I wouldn't let them touch it with a chemical. And that's because I saw it as producing something. Now, if I had to do over again, I would probably plant a lot more than I did up there, but I was in a different phase of my life. But just start asking yourself, how much grass do you really need? How much of that lawn can be converted to something a little bit more useful? I had a person write a question in to me today, and they said, I told them, I think I emailed them, told them to tune in on Monday, but I'm going to give them the answer today as part of this show. What are my plans if the shit hits the fan, we can't get gas, we don't have electricity, you know, and what am I going to do for a rototiller? I don't own a rototiller. Not going to buy one. Don't want one. Now, I'm probably going to buy a little digging machine, like a Bobcat or a little case machine or something like that when I move to Arkansas, just because I can get so much work done with it so much faster as far as putting in some tanks and, you know, pushing some swales on my own and stuff like that. But planning, you don't need to dig, folks. I mean, that was the old homesteader. He would get a plow out and start plowing up a field. What do you think you're doing, planting 10 acres of wheat? Throw mulch on the ground. Leave the ground alone. Plant legumes. Plant food in the mulch. The roots will go into the ground and they will do the work for you. Don't put chemicals on it. Worms will come. They'll fix the soil all by themselves. Don't walk where you're growing. Keep it covered with mulch and keep stuff growing in it. It'll sort itself out. It is that simple. I learned that from Bill Mollison. I was digging my brains out right up until this year. And I watched Bill terraform his little home in Australia on this video on Google Video. And I watched him lay down on a pile of mulch he just spread. He said, "See, the gardener provides a bed for not just the garden provides a bed not just for the plants, but for the gardener. You can sleep in your garden." And he said, "In 6 months, everything will be grown up so much around here, I can be out here, my wife will think I'm working, and I'll be taking a snooze on this bed of mulch." And what he said was, digging causes work. And work causes digging. Digging causes weeds, and weeds cause work. Stop digging. Look around your house. Where can you just pile up mulch and start planting? And what can you plant there that will produce food for you? Start thinking about that electric bill. What can you do to cut the electric bill? I have some interesting ideas that I won't get to really experiment with practically until I move to Arkansas. Because I don't want to make the investment here, and I don't want to tear the ground up here when I want to sell this place in less than a year. But But one of them is, there's this way the Arabs used to cool their huts thousands of years ago in the desert. They basically dig a great big trench, and they make these pipes out of clay. They put this clay pipe in the ground, and they would have one end of the pipe come out one spot, and one end of the pipe come out another spot into the house. And just by having the air flow through the pipe 10 feet underground, it would massively cool the air. And basically, they air-conditioned their huts in the middle of the desert with no electricity, with passive technology, by using ground temperature. And they did that thousands of years ago. Well, my thought is, what if you do the same thing? And put up a little solar array, and you don't need much to do this, and had a fan at one end of the pipe and a fan at the other end of the pipe, and basically had that create a current through the pipe that was a little bit stronger and pulled air into the house by that means. Completely run by solar, a little bit of electricity, yeah, but a passive system turned active. I think that would be an awesome way to improve an ancient technique that we've lost. And think about this, guys. Clay pipe's cheap. You know, compared to a lot of business, a lot of building expenses, clay pipe's pretty cheap material. There's no reason we couldn't build every home in America going forward with a system like that tied into it for almost no additional cost. Because while you're tearing the ground up and pouring foundation, putting a little trench around the home and dropping in some clay piping, and putting in some vents is going to be a very minor expense compared to the cost of new construction. But we've just lost touch with that reality. Because, you know what, if you pump Freon through a condenser, you can use it to produce some really cold air. But what is it costing you? I want you to start evaluating how you're living. On this, I want to bring up another email I got recently. Somebody, and this is a well-thought-out email, and of course, I was chastised once again for calling people sheep. You know what, don't bother me with that anymore. And no offense to the guy that did this, but really, okay? First of all, if you're listening to this show, you are not a sheep. Maybe you were a sheep, but you're not a sheep. Maybe you're a grasshopper, but you're a grasshopper on your way to becoming an ant. All right? But hold on, folks. God, these trucks try to kill you every day. They just try to run you off the road, I swear to God. Anyway, you're not a sheep if you're listening to this show. So I'm not worried about offending anybody. Because anybody who's truly a sheep is never going to listen to this show until they stop being a sheep a little bit. And then if they're just coming out of being a sheep, they probably need to be told, you're being a sheep. Anyway, I don't want to go off on a tangent about that again. But what he said is, you know, what if everybody did what you're suggesting? What if everybody got 2 to 3 acres of land and started farming and quit working, you know, typical day jobs? First of all, would it destroy the economy? And second of all, is there enough physical land even out there for 300 million people in America to do that? I said, first of all, don't worry about that because there's millions of people that are sheep, even though you don't let me call them that, that will never, ever even consider this. All right. There's also millions of people that aren't sheep, that think independently, but they like the suburban or the urban lifestyle. They enjoy it. They know, they're not fooled into this. They know what they're giving up, they know what they're sacrificing, and they know what they're gaining. They've made that decision. All right. They're the people that we call yuppies with gardens on their roofs in the suburbs, or in urban environments with rooftop gardens. Good for them. Rock on. All right. There will always be people that want to work in technology, that want to work in manufacturing. It's always been that way. It always will be that way. I want about 2 million people to go back to the land and create the stability for everybody that comes from having 2 million independent, free farmers farming 2 to 10 acres of land each, doing things organically, naturally, thinking about long-term permaculture techniques, and influencing the way that people that choose to stay in the suburbs live. So we stop building our suburbs on 10th of an acre lots, and maybe we start building them on 1/3 to 1/2. We start thinking more about what we're doing, and we get more efficient with our landscape in the city and in the country. All right, so you know that's not gonna be a problem. But on the other side of it, why do people think we always need a bigger, more robust, growing economy? Why do we always need more? Do you understand that that's not sustainable? You can't always have more. We will run. You're worried about how much physical land is there for people with 2 to 3 acres. If we keep building the economy on a concept of we have to have more, more, more of everything, more spending, more production all the time, more, 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 you have a bigger problem than people going back to land and farming and homesteading. It can't be sustained. You'll run out of resources that way. What I'm saying is we need to start consuming less resources by being more intelligent in our own lives. And the society is not ready to make the shift yet. They need someone to lead the way, someone to be an example for them. And the survivalist is the example. The survivalist is no longer, and even the media, God bless them, they're having a hard time with it, but they're starting to get this. They're starting to. There's still a bunch of idiots in the media that don't get this, that want to sensationalize it. All they're worried about is how many views that they can get, etc., and ratings. But they're starting to understand, the survivalist is not the nut job in Idaho in a bunker. The survivalist is the person that says, I will create a sustainable life for myself. And if the world goes to hell in a handbasket, I'm still going to be able to take care of myself, and I'm still going to be able to help a limited amount of other people. That's who the survivalist is today. And that's the example that you are when you're creating your home into a homestead. So again, you got to look at everything. What are the taxes on your home? One of my biggest reasons for not really making a go of it in the city, for not pulling up Joel's Derveas right in Arlington, I don't want to pay those pricks $3,600 a year anymore. And I'm sure they'll raise it next year. And even though my property values declined, they keep figuring out ways to raise my property taxes. I don't want to feed the beast that $3,600 anymore. I'd rather go somewhere where I don't need it. I don't have to earn it, and I don't have to spend it. I don't have to put it back into the system. Let somebody else fill that role if they want to. Let somebody else come buy my home and pay the beast that $3,600. And when I say the beast, it's not all biblical for you. Oh, he's freaking out now. No, I just mean the government is a beast. You know, not in older New Testament phraseology, in size, in scope, in oppression. It is a beast. Look at what it does. Look at what it's created. Look at the hardships that it's caused. Look at how it's interfering with your life. Well, every time you put a dollar into the system, you put a penny into the beast. And it gets recycled over and over and over again. Opting out of the system is a good way to stop feeding it. Starve it. I don't want to starve it to death. All right, there's a place for government. But not what we have today. Not where it's half of our society is going to end up working for the government. That's what it's going to be if we keep going down this path. Half the people in America will work for the government. They'll all be consumers. The other half of us will have to produce for them. I'm producing for enough people right now. I'm tired of it. So I've made a shift. I'm suggesting you consider making a shift as well. You don't have to move. You don't have to radically change your lifestyle. But start asking the question. Just look at your home. What here produces for me? How can I maximize that? How can I increase production and reduce consumption? Can I get on an accelerated plan to pay off my mortgage if I plan to stay here? If I'm not going to stay here, how do I increase my property value as much as possible, even under the current circumstances, and where do I want to go? What do I want to get myself into? If you start asking those questions, you'll start getting answers. That's the amazing thing, folks. The number one reason people do not find answers to their problems is they don't ask the right questions. You are extremely intelligent. I know that about you without ever meeting you. You are an extremely intelligent being. You are the most intelligent being on the planet as a human. Nothing else on this planet can rationalize. Nothing else on this planet can produce a podcast or listen to a podcast or disseminate which information they choose to use and which information they choose to discard. No one else can logically make that plan. All right, so I know you're an intelligent person. And I know that if you start asking yourself the right questions, you already have the right answers. But you can't fear the answer, and you can't fear the question, and you can't blame anybody else for your problem. I don't care if your mortgage broker lied to you, if the appraiser was in with the mortgage company and appraised your house at a higher than reasonable value. And I don't care if you had a title company that lied to you. I don't care if everybody in the process of buying your home lied to you. And now you're stuck upside down in a house. It's still your problem. And saying that it's somebody else's problem and somebody else did it to you will make you feel better about it, but it won't solve it. Doesn't matter whose fault it is. It matters that you, right now, have to fix it. And whatever your problem is, that's the same thing. I don't care if life dealt you a hard blow and you just found out yesterday you have cancer. It's your problem. I don't care if you worked in a shipyard and it's because of something you breathed in while you were working there and somebody else's fault. It's still your problem. The only way we're going to get anywhere is for people to start understanding that damn who's to blame. When you have a problem, you have ownership of the problem. And then you have to take actions to correct the problem as best you can. And sometimes you lose the battle, and that's horrible. And that sucks. But fight anyway. And one of the biggest ways you can fight today is by creating a life that gives you more, that provides more for you, that does more for you. And the place that you invest the most amount of money and sweat into is where you live. That's where you spend a tremendous amount of your time. It's where you can't wait to get back to after work. It should produce for you. Take a walk around your property today. Consider cutting something down. Consider killing something. I mean that. Find something useless on your property today and kill it and replace it with something useful. Give that a shot. We have something special coming called the 10% Project. It's going to have a lot to do with things like this. I've got a good team of people working on it right now. It's going to be really cool. Don't wait for me. We'll be retroactive to the day that I announced the 10% Project with your participation levels by recording what you've planted and what you've replaced. But go find a patch of grass. Kill the grass. Put something useful in there. Don't dig it up. Kill it with mulch. Mulch the grass to death. Put 4 inches over top of some newspaper. It'll kill it. Put something in that pile of mulch that'll grow and produce something for you. Go do it. You'll feel good about it. Get a quote. Find out what solar is going to cost for your home in various forms. Find out what wind will cost. Figure out if you can do it yourself. Build yourself a little tiny battery backup system. 2 batteries, 2 solar panels, a couple inverters, and a car radio, and a light. Create something that you control. Plan on doing it today, at least getting started today, at least writing down a plan today. Start asking yourself the tough questions. How do I get out of this problem? How do I get out of this situation? If your house is upside down and you don't want to be there anymore, how do you get out? You might leave with $10,000 in debt. It might be better than $300,000 in debt on a house that you don't want to be in. I don't know. You have to find these solutions for yourself. But I promise you, if you start thinking about converting anything in your life that's consuming your resources into something that produces for you, and if you, when you see a problem, you understand that it's your problem, it doesn't matter who did it to you, you have to fix it, and you start asking yourself, how do I fix this? And when you can't find an answer, you just keep digging, you keep looking, and you don't fall victim to victimhood. If you sit around and you see yourself as a victim, you will never, ever, ever fix your problems. You will never take your lifestyle from one that consumes your resources to one that provides for you, as long as you see yourself as a victim. I don't care if you've been injured. I don't care if you've been wronged. I don't care if you've been stolen from. Problem belongs to you. Solve it. That's what made this country at one time great. And it's what's killing it that people won't accept their own problems and won't solve their own problems. And I know you can solve your problem because I have faith in you. I have belief in you. And I mean that. These aren't just pretty words. These aren't just motivational thoughts. If I didn't believe the things that I say, I couldn't get in a car, drive down the road, and do this show every day. I do it because I do believe in your ability, your intelligence, your creativity, your ingenuity. I believe in that. And I believe if you tap into it, it'll go a long way toward helping you build that better life. This has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to build that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
Man, you can scream and you can holler. It really doesn't matter because it all gets spent.